Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Talks on the Ukraine crisis with Russia are underway this week. They will draw on a full range of family feelings between cousin countries, geographically the two largest nations in Europe. The urgent issue is their political and military tilts toward one another and the West after the bonds of the Soviet Union broke 30 years ago. Already, the threats and warnings make it gamesmanship galore. Our guest, with a lifetime's experience watching Ukraine and Russia and the West, says we'd all do better to frame this situation as a predictable problem with a ready solution. Anatole Levin in London, I read your striking piece on Ukraine in the Quincy Institute letter this week, and I wonder if you've nearly dissolved the crisis by framing it differently. Short form, you're saying neutralize Ukraine and enlist the U.S. and Russia in keeping it sovereign and out of play in the wider world. It's a strategy with a history and a certain logic. Explain, why neutralize?
Well, what I think most of the Western and U.S. debate on this issue of neutrality for Ukraine has completely forgotten is that it cuts both ways. It rules out Ukrainian military alliance with NATO and the USA, but it also rules out the kind of Ukrainian alliance with Russia that Vladimir Putin has hoped for. In other words, this is a perfectly reasonable reciprocal arrangement. It isn't simply a surrender to Russian demands, because I would say that clearly we cannot agree to Russia's demands without asking for Russian concessions and guarantees in return.
What would they be giving up?
They would be giving up the chance to take Ukraine back into a close alliance with Russia. And you've got to remember, I mean, Ukraine is far, far more important to Russia than it is to the West. Putin's whole dream, I mean, Russia's whole dream of recreating a serious international bloc led by Russia depended on Ukraine. From that point of view, 2014 was a terrible defeat for Russia, and an agreement on Ukrainian neutrality would consolidate that defeat. In other words, this would not be a victory for Putin, but it would be a guarantee of Russian security and thereby end Russia's, well, depending on your point of view, you could say either paranoia or justified concern about NATO expansion.
What I remember not well is the neutralization of Austria after World War II. It came in 1955, and both the Russians and the Americans and NATO sealed it, and it seemed to have worked like a charm.
Yes, indeed. Austria, like Finland too, by the way, developed as a successful free market democracy. There was nothing in that agreement that brought about Soviet or communist domination of Austria or of Finland. You know, it always puzzles me when people talk about Finlandization as if it were some kind of descent into hell. I visited Finland during the last years of the Cold War, and, you know, it was a fully developed, extremely successful Western democracy. There is nothing bad for Ukraine in such an agreement.
There's a deeper logic here, too, and speak about it. We have never conceded it in dealing with Russia, but Putin wants NATO off his borders, as we would want Chinese military power out of Mexico. And that goes back, actually, to World War I. It's part of what got us into World War I was discovery that Germany was meddling in Mexico, so off we went. But it's the story of the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy put the world in the balance, really, to insist that there would be no Russian missiles in Cuba. There's a long history of that sort of thing. Explain that logic and why we resisted in the case of NATO heading toward Russia.
This is what the great American international relations theorist Hans Morgenthau meant when he said that it was a fundamental duty of statesmen to put themselves in the shoes of their opposite numbers in order to understand, not necessarily always to agree with them, in order to understand what they regard as their country's vital interests. Now, any country dealing with the United States has to understand that America, for almost 200 years, you know, under the rubric of the Monroe Doctrine,
right,
has regarded the exclusion of hostile or potentially hostile alliances from its backyard as a vital American interest for which, in the last resort, America is prepared to go to war. And short of that, of course, America has backed, you know, a long, long set of really horrible regimes in Central America and the Caribbean, as long as they have sided with America in, you know, excluding that kind of foreign or communist influence. And there is no doubt at all that America will go on doing that. I think the Chinese are far too wise to do this, but any Chinese attempt to bring Central American countries into a Chinese alliance, there can be no doubt at all that America will react with extreme ruthlessness and will use whatever force is necessary to prevent that. Morgenthau's point, of course, is that, you know, setting aside self-righteousness and American exceptionalism, you know, Russia makes exactly the same calculations. There is nothing at all mysterious or weird or hidden or concealed about Russia's motives. They are very much those of the United States in similar circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely, in the Monroe Doctrine. I've heard the acronym NUPIMBY, No Unfriendly Powers in My Backyard. Also, NOPIMIC, No Paws in My Knickers. The rule that fired up the Cuban Missile Crisis, as we know, Monroe Doctrine 2, it's why China entered the Korean War full force when the United States drove north of the 38th parallel in the early 50s. It's pretty simple when you get down to it. But I wonder, historically, psychologically, about us, why do we not accord that understanding to Russia? Or should we?
It's nationalism. It is American nationalism in the end, the refusal to understand that the United States can be compared to other countries, its motives and behavior, the automatic assumption that American motives are purer and that America's role in leading the world towards democracy and freedom somehow justifies or excuses American actions, which are in fact just as ruthless and or illegal as those of other countries. Of course, in addition, there are particular prejudices towards Russia created by the Cold War and created by ethnic lobbies and, of course, US alliances with countries that have their own, I mean, perfectly genuine reasons for historical fear and hatred of Russia, like Poland and the Baltic states.
Right.
What we tend to forget is that it's a bit like, you know, victims of violent crime. You have to sympathise with them, just as you have to sympathise with the Poles and the Balts. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to endorse or support or regard as rational, you know, all the very understandable but nonetheless often mistaken ways in which victims of crime are apt to react and see the world.
There's so much more I want you to tell us about Ukraine itself and its modern history, as well as its ancient roots, older than Russia in some sense, and deeply entwined socially, culturally, family-wise. But I also want to ask you, why haven't we heard the neutrality solution, which makes a certain sense to me, from Secretary Blinken or from the Biden administration, in the New York Times, for example?
Well, it's what's called in academic speak path dependency. You know, ever since the mid-90s, and remember, I mean, this was a process and strategy initiated by the Clinton administration, but subsequently followed by Bush, by Obama, by Trump. You know, there's been a bipartisan consensus in America behind NATO expansion, and that makes it very difficult to recognize that there are situations in which NATO expansion has to stop. Part of the problem as well is that from the very beginning in the mid-90s, NATO membership, new NATO membership, was phrased in terms not of military security and a willingness or ability to defend new members. It was treated as a kind of confirmation and prize for progress towards democracy and the free market. Well, the problem about that is that it created an absolute, you know, imperative and an unstoppable desire for every former communist country to join NATO as well as the European Union. Even when, as we have known since 2008 and the Georgian war with Russia, we have no either intention or ability to defend these countries. To be prepared actually to defend Ukraine as a member of NATO, we'd have to go back to the military configurations of the Cold War. America would have to move a huge army back to Europe, a large part of the American Air Force. European countries would have to reintroduce conscription and vastly increase their military budgets. Nobody intends to do that. NATO does not have a plan to defend Ukraine. So the problem is we've been trapped by our own rhetoric. And even when the actual issue has become completely empty and surreal, you know, the issue of an Article 5 guarantee to Ukraine, we don't have the vision and the moral courage to accept military realities and move instead to a reasonable compromise.
You make me wonder how we'd get a conversation started on this bipartisan slogan of NATO expansion to the east. But then I'm vaguely remembering, I thought it was George H.W. Bush who promised at the time of German reunification that there would be no NATO expansion to the east. It turns out it was Secretary Baker who said it sort of on his own. It was never affirmed. But isn't that a conversation we ought to start again?
Absolutely. And I mean, the Russians have been kicking themselves ever since that, you know, Gorbachev and Shevardnadze did not get that in writing and did not get a formal commitment. But no, it's quite true. That promise was made. I talked to someone who was in the room at the time who confirmed that. But of course, as far as NATO membership of Poland, the Baltic states are concerned, I mean, that is water under the bridge. They are now members of NATO. And, you know, we do have an absolute commitment to defend them. Part of why Polish and Baltic policy is so stupid from their own point of view is that by trying to get NATO to, you know, issue guarantees to Ukraine that NATO does not intend to keep and cannot keep, you're not strengthening NATO's commitment to the defence of Poland and the Baltic states. You are, in fact, weakening it because you're suggesting that Article 5 is not an absolute guarantee. It's not a guarantee that we are bound to honour. So it's not just, you know, America and West European countries, but it is also some of Russia's neighbours who've got themselves into a profoundly contradictory and mistaken position from their own point of view.
Coming up, who is this Anatol Levin and what is his Quincy Institute? This is Open Source. Anatol Levin, make the connection with the Quincy Institute, named for John Quincy Adams, president of the United States 200 years ago, patron saint of restraint in foreign policy. He said, America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to freedom and independence of all. That's the Quincy Institute's restraint mantra. How'd you meet?
Well, you could say that we met, in a sense, 18 years ago, when all the people, or most of the people now involved with the Quincy, including myself, were opponents of the US invasion of Iraq. Of course, we were a minority and in many areas unpopular and assaulted minority. But that's really where the original impetus for the Quincy came from. And then, you know, it took another 17 years or whatever it was to actually bring the Quincy together and get the funding. But, you know, the people in the Quincy, Andrew Basevich, for example, you know, Trita Parsi, Michael Swain, myself, we have been arguing for restraint in US policy and, you know, reasonable compromise on the world stage and the search for international peace and stability as the basis for international progress. You know, essentially, we've been arguing this for more than a generation now, you know, in my case, since the mid-1990s.
I have to say here, you have deep credit with me. First time I read you in the London Review of Books, 20 years ago, October of 2002, and you saw, this was before the shooting started, but you saw, obviously, the war in Iraq coming. You called it profoundly reckless, destructive of international institutions, an invitation down the long road to terrorism everywhere, a wrecking ball, you thought, of American consensus. This was pre-Trump. You saw a kind of preview of right-wing Republican populism, and a war, not least, that would be generally excoriated, more than any other in modern memory, which it turns out to be. You saw something, and I want to know not just the story of Ukraine, but how Anatole Levin works and how your mind somehow gets ahead of our game, not only the diplomacy, the military policy, but the journalism.
Well, thank you so much for your kind words. I suppose originally it comes from two things. I was trained as a historian. On my father's side, I come from a Baltic German family from what's now Latvia and Estonia, so I have an East European background. And I've always been aware, since I was really, you know, quite small, of the catastrophe of the First World War and the way in which European countries, every one of them absolutely convinced that it was fighting in self-defense and, you know, for civilization and that it was morally superior to everybody else. You know, how they between them began the process of the, you know, near destruction of European civilization, which then continued, of course, with the communists in Russia and with the Nazis. You know, if you come from a sort of mixed German, Russian, you know, Latvian background, that is something that's pretty deeply, you know, sunk into your bones. The other thing is that on my mother's side, I come from an Irish family. They served in India for a long time. And then I was in India first as a student and then as a journalist. And, you know, if you've worked in the former colonial world and, you know, really listened to people there, and if you have a historical sense, you cannot avoid the perception that Western powers, you know, have many, many sins in their own records and on their own shoulders. I was a lifelong anti-communist. You know, the sins of communism were terrible. The notion that somehow makes the West and Western empires morally pure, you know, is a logical and moral non sequitur. So I've always had this sense that we don't look nearly as good to the rest of the world as we think we do and as we look to ourselves. And connected with that, the anger felt in much of the world when America and Britain, and sometimes the European Union as well, talk about the international community as if this was the either just the West or this was led by the West and including any other good and obedient countries that would recognise that the West is right and will follow the rest. You know, this is once again not how the rest of the world sees things. So that gave me, I think, a lifelong element of perspective. But also, I mean, there was one specific thing which really began my own personal process of disenchantment with American and Western policy, and also an awareness of how very mistaken a consensus in the Western media can be. And that was that I covered the Afghan War of the 1980s. I was a British journalist. I accompanied the Mujahideen. And then in the summer, along with various colleagues of 89, after the Soviets withdrew, we managed to travel to Kabul. We got visas to go in on the communist side. And it came home to me that the way in which the West had supported, you know, some truly terrible elements among the Mujahideen and had supported elements which were viciously retrograde in their attitudes to women, you know, to modern progress in general, and were in absolutely no sense the democratic freedom fighters that the Western media had presented them as. That was a shock from which I have to say my faith in the Western media has never fully recovered.
Interesting. Anatole, speak of your own identity in the journalism world now. You hate it. You do it brilliantly. Where should we be getting our news and how?
Well, I loved being a foreign correspondent, although I covered several wars and, you know, saw a great deal of inhumanity and nastiness. But I had a most interesting time in South Asia, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, the former Soviet Union. And I only left because, frankly, the number of staff positions in international journalism in the 90s and since just went down and down. And also, I mean, my hope and ambition was always to be a foreign correspondent based somewhere and really getting to know that country and that area, you know, which is what I was as a junior journalist in Pakistan and then as correspondent in Russia. But of course, more and more, you have this situation where, you know, even leading Western publications no longer have foreign correspondents. You know, they parachute in correspondents from New York or Washington or London, and the rest of the time they rely on agency reports. And as a result, you have people writing who are profoundly ignorant of the countries that they're writing about, and in many cases have never read a single serious book on the subject. I mean, that ain't my kind of journalism. And it's also, frankly, just from a purely objective and practical point of view, it is a rotten way to run a global empire. You need American elites, including senators and congressmen, who actually know something about the world. If all they're getting is instant expertise from profoundly ignorant and bigoted Western journalists who don't even live in the countries that they're writing about, well, garbage in, garbage out. You get misinformation in, and you get rotten policies coming out.
I'm wondering, as you speak, is there a name for people in your position? I think of the Coburn brothers. I think of Steve Kinzer, formerly with the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and others. Wonderfully useful writers on the world, but had to get free of journalism, so-called.
Well, yes, I mean, and of course, there have been a row of great American journalists and writers. You know, if one thinks of Afghanistan, one thinks of Anand Gopal, for example, you know, who has written brilliantly about the real nature of Afghanistan. If you think about China, you know, Peter Hessler for The New Yorker. The point is, of course, that these are people who really lived in the countries concerned for long periods and got to know them intimately. We just need more people like that. People stationed abroad and willing really to learn about the countries where they're stationed.
Anatoly, even take us into the bones of the Ukraine story, as you were just suggesting about your own legacy from the Baltic side of the family. It's the larger question of Russian domination or identity with Kiev. It's an old, old story going back to the golden age of Kiev before Russia, and then the history is spliced ever since, all meticulously noted. Solzhenitsyn's mother was Ukrainian. Khrushchev had a wife who was Ukrainian. So did Gorbachev. Brezhnev was a Russian but came from Ukraine. Yevtushenko, the poet who did a radio program with us once upon a time, he was a Ukrainian. Endless lists of movie stars, writers, boxers, hockey players, but speak of the relevant history today and the feeling as Ukrainians get it.
Well, as I can't remember whether it was Alec Baldwin said to Meryl Streep or Meryl Streep said to Alec Baldwin, it's complicated.
Even from the breakup of the Soviet Union, 1991, Ukraine turned up as an independent state, but the history was Russian domination.
Well, Russian or Polish, yes.
Putin grabbed the Crimea from Ukraine in 2014. The US, President Obama, sanctioned him. But from time to time, as now, Putin puts the world on edge for another bold stroke to restore his idea of greater Russia from the Soviet days and before. How do the Ukrainians see it? How do you feel it?
Well, the Ukrainians are, of course, deeply divided on this subject. When the West talks about the Ukrainian people, that is a very misleading formula. After all, until 2014, in election after election, it was a bit like the Democrats and the Republicans in America. The vote between pro-Russian parties and more or less anti-Russian or pro-Western parties, you know, really only shifted from election to election over about 3 or 4%. In other words, getting on for half of Ukrainians always wanted to maintain a good relationship with Russia. And it's very important to note from that point of view that while a majority of Ukrainians always wanted to join the European Union for very understandable, you know, economic reasons, they always saw that as full membership of the European Union, not what they've got, which is, you know, a bit like Turkey, an endless, endless waiting room. But according to every opinion poll, large majorities, two-thirds or more of Ukrainians, before 2014, always opposed Ukrainian membership of NATO for the simple reason that they knew that this would lead to a drastic deterioration of relations with Russia, and they wanted to somehow combine good relations with the West and good relations with Russia. And that, it seems to me, and I wrote a book about this in 1999 called Ukraine and Russia, a Fraternal Rivalry.
Fraternal rivalry.
Yes, because it's sort of...
Siblings.
Yeah, quarrelling siblings, but still siblings. But the other element is, from Russia's point of view, you know, we've talked about the Monroe Doctrine and, you know, Russian strategic concerns. But the point as well is that, as you said, by mentioning Yevtushenko, one could also talk about Gogol or Hohol in Ukrainian, great Ukrainian writer in Russian. One could talk about Bondarchuk, the Soviet director of war and peace, also Ukrainian. But there is this deep cultural connection, and a quarter of the Ukrainian population still, at least if you include Donbass and Crimea, thinks of itself as ethnically Russian. And another 10% or so speak Russian as their first language.
Donbass being a cell, in effect, of Russophile Ukrainians insisting on their own sovereignty within an independent Ukraine, as I get it.
That's it, yes. But including, you see, the right to maintain Russian as their local official language. This, by the way, is widely felt in eastern and southern Ukraine beyond the areas now controlled by Russia. And in recent years, and particularly the last year, the Ukrainian government and parliament have passed a series of laws, which, by the way, have been denounced by the European Parliament as basically undemocratic, which have basically moved towards abolishing the public use of Russian in higher education, in government, and so on. The other aspect of Russia's response is this fear that basically moves are underway to destroy Russian culture in Ukraine and the entire historical basis of the Ukrainian-Russian relationship. So that's the other motivation for Russian behaviour. I mean, as far as the historical relationship is concerned, it's a little bit like some mixture of the relationship between Scotland with England and Ireland with England. In other words, on the one hand, you have terrible atrocities, including famine, of course, in both cases, in Ireland and Ukraine. But on the other, you have the fact that so many Scots, just like so many Ukrainians, enthusiastically joined the Russian and the Soviet empires. The British Empire was, in fact, largely a Scottish empire, although Scottish nationalists choose to forget that by now, just as Ukrainian nationalists choose to forget that, you know, the Russian and Soviet empires were, in fact, largely Ukrainian.
Right. The Scots were the officer class, and the Irish, in many cases, were the troops.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anatole, is there any summarizing the emotional complexity of the Ukrainian-Russian connection over centuries?
Well, yes, it goes back more than 1,000 years. Russians trace their own statehood to the early medieval state of Rus, whose capital was actually in Kiev, what is now the capital of Ukraine. So, I mean, this is a deeply, deeply intertwined relationship. The separation of what's now Ukraine from Russia, or rather the difference between the two countries, you know, stems back to the Mongolian destruction of Kievan Rus in the 13th century, and then the fact that most of what's now Ukraine was conquered by the Lithuanians and the Poles, and for several hundred years, therefore, was subject to a rival state to Russia, which also meant the Ukrainian and Russian languages, although they have their origin in the same old Slavonic language of the Eastern Slavs. Of course, they developed separately, like, I don't know, German and Danish or French and Spanish. So it's a very, very deep intertwined relationship with aspects, of course, of resentment and rivalry and hostility on the Ukrainian side because of the way in which, you know, Ukraine was then incorporated into the Russian Empire in the 17th and 18th century, with the support at the time, it must be said, of a great many Ukrainians. But the Russian Empire, as empires do, then treated Ukraine in many ways oppressively and attempted, for example, to suppress the Ukrainian language. And then, of course, there was terrible suffering in Ukraine under Stalinism, although this does not appear to have been actually, whatever the Ukrainian nationalists say, directed specifically against Ukrainians, because a large population of, part of the population of southern Russia also suffered terribly in collectivization and the artificial famine of the early 1930s. But all of this has, you know, created a very complicated relationship which combines elements of great closeness with elements of rivalry. And then, of course, there is the fact that because of settlement in southern Ukraine, what's now southern Ukraine, which was actually unoccupied, non-sovereign territory disputed between Russia, Poland and Turkey until the later 18th century. But southern Ukraine was settled by a mixture of Ukrainians, Russians and everybody else under the sun, really, Germans, Bulgarians. But as a result of that, you have a situation in which about a quarter of the Ukrainian population has historically considered itself to be ethnic Russian, which of course gives Russia a tremendous stake in Ukraine today. By the way, I mean, a huge part of the population of Russia, especially in Siberia, still considers itself ethnically Ukrainian. So the two countries are really, really, you know, mixed up. And there are also tremendous number of intermarriages.
Should we be reminded of the former Yugoslavia?
Well, that in Western Ukraine, you know, which was not part of the Russian Empire and was not part of the Soviet Union till Stalin conquered it in 1939, yes, I mean, it is much more like the feeling of Croats about Serbs and Serbs right. about Muslims. But in much of the rest of Ukraine, it's a much more mixed and much more moderate feeling. One of the tragedies is, and for this, you know, you can blame Putin's policies of trying to draw Ukraine into a tight alliance and also the West policies, is that a country which really, really needed left alone to find its own way and not forced to choose between a Russian and a Western alliance, because of the irresponsible and arrogant ambitions on both sides, has been torn apart in a way that most Ukrainians never, ever wanted, and which I believe was completely unnecessary.
Coming up, how to change the course of history before it happens by reframing the big questions. This is Open Source. This is Open Source with the historian and writer at large, Anatol Levin. The thing that interests me most, even in this conversation, is how we start another way of talking about these things. We have a military policy toward NATO and Ukraine. We don't seem to have a political or much less social or cultural relationship with this incredibly rich history. How would we get it going? How can we change, even you and I, change the conversation around Ukraine and the questions it poses?
Well, I think the first question to ask anyone who advocates unconditional Western support for Ukrainian nationalism is, are you prepared to fight? Are you prepared for America to go to war with Russia to defend Ukraine? If you're not, oh, and by the way, one might add to that, are you personally prepared to go and fight for Ukraine? Or are you prepared to see your children, you know, your son go and fight? Because if you're not, then logically, you must be prepared in the last resort to accept some kind of compromise. Because after all, as I've said, saying that we must keep the offer of NATO membership open for Ukraine, if you admit that we're not going to fight ever to defend Ukraine, I mean, that is nothing more nor less than a lie. You're lying. You know, you're saying you're prepared to fight for someone when you're not.
You're bluffing. You're sticking your chin out.
Yeah, but sticking your chin out for a blow which you're not prepared to answer, and which, by the way, won't land on you. It will land on millions of unfortunate Ukrainians. So that, I think, is the first point to make. And then having established that, you have to start asking, you know, as one does in any sensible negotiation, what we are prepared to offer Russia to compromise with Russian interests and what we have to demand in return. If we are going to meet Russian demands over Ukraine and over, you know, no additional stationing of NATO troops in Eastern Europe, which, by the way, that was formally promised by NATO and by the US, then, you know, we are entitled to ask in return for a guarantee from Russia that they will not seek to bring Ukraine into a military alliance, and also that Russia will not station additional troops in areas adjacent to NATO, Kaliningrad, Transnistria, Belarus, and Crimea. That is an entirely reasonable, just, fair, traditional solution to this kind of dispute.
But it strikes me, it's not just a compromise. I'm not sure compromise is the best word. It's a more open recognition of subtleties in the real relationships day to day, and the complexities in the minds of Ukrainians for sure, and probably the Russians too. In other words, it's not a half a loaf. It's let's get to know the fact. Let's get to know each other in some more real way. How do we do that? I got to ask you, could you negotiate the neutralization with both the Russians and NATO, do you think? With the Biden administration?
I could on behalf of the United States. I have to say nobody has asked me to do so. Well, I'm waiting for the call. I would answer the call if asked.
Where would you begin?
The first thing I have to say is where I would not begin, and I say this, as you can tell from my accent, I'm not from here, I'm British. I would not begin by involving the Europeans in these negotiations. If you do that, that becomes an excuse for just kicking the ball down the road indefinitely, because, of course, the Europeans can't agree on anything. You've got, you know, countries which are more favourable, like Germany, to an accommodation with Russia. You've got others like Poland and Sweden, which are basically opposed to any agreement whatsoever on any terms. So leave them out of it, for God's sake. The second thing is, you know, that you can't make this dependent on the Ukrainian establishment, because it is also deeply divided and terrified of its own nationalist extremists. So you've basically got to come to an agreement and then, you know, tell the Ukrainians that if they want continued US support, they'd better lump it. If one starts with those two conditions, then I believe that the essential terms of an agreement with Russia are pretty clear. I mean, of course, one has to insist, as I've said, on elements of reciprocity. But I think that would be acceptable to the Russians simply because, from their point of view, you know, over the past 25 years, they have been pushed back and pushed back. And the lack of any formal agreement has meant that, you know, in every crisis, the West has taken more and they have lost. So a reciprocal agreement on mutual restraint would, I believe, be acceptable to Moscow. The other point, of course, to be made is I don't believe that Russia has the slightest intention of attacking or trying to subjugate existing NATO members. The risks would be colossal and the gains would be minimal. But, of course, we must repeatedly stress that as far as all existing members are concerned, and that emphatically includes Poland and the Baltic states, Article 5 is absolute. If, by any chance, Russia or anyone else attack them, we will fight.
Anatoly Lieben, how hard it is for you to publish your reporting and your views in the mainstream American press, much less CNN and television?
It's difficult.
And I wonder why.
They don't agree with me. I mean, many, many, many people who have disagreed with the establishment consensus in America have had this experience. You know, after all, Noam Chomsky wrote a whole book about this, and Edward Herman, you know, manufacturing consent.
Right, and yet Chomsky is quoted everywhere.
True, yes. He's quoted, but is he listened to?
On our program he is, yeah.
Well, yes. But of course, the other thing is, not that I ever had that ambition, or could have as a British citizen, but one thing I think you can say of everybody at the Quincy, and possibly on your program and in, you know, various other dissident American publications, is that we none of us think that we're going to be offered senior roles in the next US administration, right?
That I'll grant you. But a bigger piece of the public conversation, we need it. I want to go back 20 years ago because you were so clear in your vision of the Iraq war, what was driving it, who was driving it, what questions were not being asked, which things came true. You warned at the end of that piece in the London Review that a war in Iraq could be catastrophic whether or not the United States prevailed. It was easy enough to prevail against what missile defenses Iraq had. But you also thought that a radical nationalist, sort of all-intimidating imperial U.S. that drove that war could turn the country as well as the world against the Bush-Cheney, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld crowd. It didn't exactly. Alternatively, you thought it could consolidate a new populist and evangelical right-wing Republican Party driven by, you wrote, a classical nationalist desire for a return to a golden age, meaning the pre-Vietnam 1950, sounds like Make America Great Again, going backwards. I want you to account for us in the world today, how we look, how we're doing. You said at the end of that piece, what you saw coming was the tragedy of a great country with noble impulses, successful institutions, magnificent historical achievements, and immense energies, which has become a menace to itself and to mankind. Strong words, but it's hard to say you were far off.
Well, I was half right. Of course, where I was wrong, as it turns out, is that, of course, the disaster of Iraq did not produce within America the kind of backlash which I had expected. But of course, when it comes, yes, I mean, to the consolidation of a reactionary Republican desire for a return to an imagined golden age, well, yes, that was right enough. I think, you see, in the world at large, there will always be a range of countries that will support the US, more or less whatever the US does, because they themselves, for their own local reasons, desperately want US support and help. So, you know, the US position in the Far East is not just anchored in US imperialism. Several countries in the region really want America to be there because they're afraid of China. Just as, you know, in Eastern Europe, for, you know, reasons that I regard as, you know, to some extent paranoid, but which are nonetheless historically understandable, you have a row of countries that really want America to be there because they are historically very much afraid of Russia. And then, of course, you have the West Europeans, for whom I have considerably less sympathy, who, at least one, you know, because of the Second World War, you can understand this, I suppose, but are deeply, deeply unwilling to take responsibility for their own security, you know, or to pay for their own security. And so in the end, you have a whole row of countries and others, you know, like India, who regard America as essentially a supporter of their own great power or superpower aspirations. And in the Middle East, of course, you have, you know, some countries like Qatar, which want defence against their neighbours. Other countries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, frankly, want America to help prop up their own rotten domestic regimes. There is not going to be a global backlash against American power, but equally, there is not ever again going to be a real sense of America leading democracy and progress in a way that, in Europe at least, that, you know, really was felt at certain moments in the past. But given America's present role in the world, it is very difficult to believe that. And I have to say, you know, I taught for 7 years in the Middle East.
Where?
Georgetown University in Qatar.
Ah, okay.
And many, many of my students there from the Middle East and South Asia wanted America as an ally of their country or their own regimes for very good local reasons. But I have to say, not one of them in 7 years, not one student in 7 years believed that America was sincerely committed to democracy and freedom in their regions. Because, of course, there was absolutely nothing in their history which would tend to support that.
Anatole, from the beginning in my mind, the question is, can you change history by reframing the basic questions? Can you change things by changing the conversation? I want to go back for a sec to that debate on Ukraine. All sorts of opinions, and yet an absolutely unbroken consensus, I would say, from people on the ground in the region. Putin will not invade Ukraine in the current emergency, and the United States would not go to war for Ukraine if he did. In other words, there's something of pseudo-drama here. There's something of a stage drama going on here, and I wondered how you cut through it.
Well, I absolutely believe that when it comes to these ridiculous speculations about a Russian attack on NATO, or even the Swedes have started talking about the possibility of a Russian invasion of Sweden, which sort of does rather ignore the existence of a large bit of wet territory called the Baltic Sea, apart from anything else. You know, in any case, absolute just garbage, nonsense. I am not so sure when it comes to Ukraine. I hope that is true, and I would still say that the odds are against it. But I think that the odds have shortened considerably.
He did snatch Crimea, after all.
Well, yes. And, you know, Russian so-called volunteers fought very hard in the Donbass. I mean, the play acting, absolutely, it's NATO posturing about, you know, its heroic defiance of Russia in defence of places that Russia will never, in fact, attack. But I wish I could be sure that Russia will not attack Ukraine. I don't think that Russia will annex any more of Ukraine, any more than it's actually annexed the Donbass. But I can see a situation in which Russia would occupy more territory and then use that as the basis for a new, you know, negotiating position, which would be on the basis, once again, of Ukrainian neutrality, but also of a federal Ukraine with, you know, guarantees for the Russian minority. I can imagine that actually as being possible, unfortunately. I mean, I pray that it doesn't happen.
What can you do beyond praying?
Talk, argue, write. And it must be said, and I don't disagree with this at all, make clear to Russia that it would pay a very, very heavy economic price.
Which Biden has said, yeah.
Yes, and correctly so. You know, that this would badly damage the Russian economy. And there is also a factor which of course would be very bad for America and the West, but is also, you know, very much feared by many Russians, which is that in those circumstances, Russia would be driven completely into the pocket of China. So you would get a much, much closer Russian-Chinese relationship, which would be bad for the West. But, of course, the point is that Russians fear that because China would be absolutely the dominant partner, both economically and strategically. Russia was never willing to become simply an obedient satellite of the United States. But it doesn't want to become an obedient satellite of China either. So the economic threat of retaliation if Russia invades Ukraine is, I think, it's necessary and it's also powerful.
Anatole, last question. For you, as a commentator of real experience and depth on the margin, so to speak, how do we enliven our own debate about ourselves in the world?
I would say that fundamental to that, as far as educated Americans are concerned, is a sense of history and a study of history. When I wrote my book on American nationalism in 2004 in response to the Iraq War, one of its purposes was really to recall great American writers and thinkers of the past, from Tocqueville on, although, well, he was French, but anyway, and especially of the anti-Vietnam War generation, you know, like Richard Hofstadter and C. Vann Woodward, who made all these points.
Mark Twain in the Philippines.
Indeed. So many of the arguments against the Iraq War and against subsequent American behavior have not been, in a sense, original. They were made more than 50 years ago, or indeed, as you say, Mark Twain. They were made, you know, 150 years ago. It is necessary for Americans, and by the way, I would say that absolutely about my own country, Britain, with regard to its own history, you know, seriously to re-engage with their own history, not just in a mood of blind criticism, but to recall, you know, all the great Americans who have done this in the past.
The British press was as bad as ours on the Iraq War, but are you thinking of a kind of revisionist view of the British Empire, going back to Edmund Burke?
That's a key part of it. I mean, it may be apocryphal or legendary, but supposedly a group of British experts on the Middle East asked to talk to Tony Blair, or for their view to be passed on to Tony Blair, reminding Blair of all the historical reasons why people in the Middle East would not trust Britain of all places, you know, to bring freedom and democracy.
Right.
And the response apparently from one of Blair's staff was, look, I could try, but believe me, it won't work. The Prime Minister lives in an ahistorical zone. In a sense, I mean, that is how our cultures as a whole, they have become ahistorical. And as such, for that reason, of course, the British, when they agreed to go into Afghanistan, seem to have forgotten totally the entire history of the British Empire in Afghanistan, which meant, of course, that Britain was a particular focus of Afghan hostility, very understandably.
Willie Dalrymple has written a wonderful history of the first Afghan war, the Brits being chased out to a man, woman, and child in 1839 and 40, that sort of thing. But we don't normally think of Britain as amnesiac, as we're accustomed to thinking of ourselves. But sorry to hear.
Yes, so am I.
Anatol Lieben, we need to hear more of what you know. And we're immensely appreciative of your work and of your conversation with us. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
In his latest book, new in paperback, Anatol Lieben maintains that climate change is a far bigger threat to the world's great powers, like the U.S. and China, than they are to each other. The title is Climate Change and the Nation State, the Realist Case. Our show this week was produced by Mary McGrath and Adam Coleman. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.